I'm Paul Wegraff, director of the Delaware Division of the Arts, and your host for today. Joining me in the studio are two representatives of Winterthur Museum and Garden and Library. Winterthur Museum, Garden and Library, got that right. Liz Farrell, the manager of public relations, who's been with us before, and Linda Eaton, the director of collections and senior curator of textiles, who I think this is your first visit to us, correct?
I think I've been here once a long time ago.
Okay, yeah. Long time ago. Well, it's great to have you back. Winterthur, one of those just cultural gems of the Brandywine Valley and Delaware in particular. It's great having you both with us today.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
Liz, let's start with you. Just a little bit of background about Winterthur for those people who I can't imagine anyone hasn't heard of Winterthur, but a little bit about its background, its history, Henry Francis DuPont, and
certainly, yes. Well, Winterthur is a beautiful 1,000-acre country estate that was home to three generations of the DuPont family, including founder Henry Francis DuPont. It's often referred to, as you note, as a unique national treasure, and I have to say that we agree. Mm-hmm. There is a 175-room Winterthur Museum, and that houses one of the premier collections of American decorative arts in the world. Winterthur has a 60-acre naturalistic garden. It is one of the oldest and considered one of the best of its kind in North America. And within that is the 3-acre magical children's garden in Chanet Woods. Winterthur also has a research library that serves an international audience as an academic center for the study of American art and culture. And we also have two on-site graduate programs offered in partnership with the University of Delaware, the Winterthur Program in Early American Culture, and the Winterthur University of Delaware Program in Art Conservation. And we are open to the public from March 1 through early January each year.
So you just reopened recently from a few months off?
Correct, yes.
Now, I'm curious, what does the Winterthur staff do when you're not open to the public?
Well, it would be great if we could just get up on our workouts and things like that, but actually it is a hub and a hive of activity. Mm-hmm. We're all getting ready for the opening on March 1. Our major exhibition this year is Treasures on Trial, which Linda will talk about, and just a host of exciting garden programs, concerts, Winterthur After Hours events for people to socialize and come and have some wine and view the exhibition galleries. We have just a host of things that we get ready for. So we are actually really busy. And of course, Point to Point is coming up in May.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, as a former history teacher, I have always been fascinated by Winterthur. Because, I mean, it offers so much to the visitor. It's not only the estate and the decorative arts that are just exquisite, but also a real lesson in history. And then, as you mentioned, the grounds, what, 60-plus acres, I think you said?
Yes, it has a 60-acre naturalistic garden.
Just beautiful, beautiful grounds. So no matter what your interest is, whether it's the artistic or the historic or the natural, it has all of that encompassed in that property. It's really quite magnificent. Now, how did it become public? Because it was initially a private estate. Was it not?
Yes, it was. Starting in 1839, it then was home to three generations of the DuPont family. And Henry Francis DuPont, who took it over from his father in the 1920s, decided along the way to turn it into a museum. And it was opened to the public in 1951 as a museum. And he is actually responsible for expanding it to its current size of 9 stories and 175 rooms. So it's quite an amazing place, yes.
And could you speak to, for those not familiar with Winterthur, could you speak to how the rooms were conceived, those 177 rooms? Because
yes.
Each one is so uniquely different.
Very different. And I'm going to invite Linda,
I was gonna
who
say,
is the expert in this.
I should talk about
please.
Sure.
provide some information.
Because what is so interesting is that Winterthur really is a 20th century institution, and we have only relatively recently embraced the 20th story and the DuPonts living there. Before, in the 1950s, in the late 20th century, people were looking at them as period rooms mm-hmm. of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And it's true that we have iconic collections of antiques from those periods, but they were put together in the 20th century by Henry Francis DuPont, who considered his rooms to be his works of art. And so they've also been overlaid with value from interior designers and artists. I always try to claim that DuPont was the first installation artist, and everybody laughs at me, but I think it's true. Mm-hmm. That's what he was doing. He was a very close friend of Albert Barnes. Mm-hmm. He was very involved with the Whitney Museum and contemporary art movements. And so he was really decorating with the eye of his time, but using antiques. And so we've got that kind of double thing. We've got a great 20th century story of a wealthy family who are collecting and displaying art. But then we've also got the objects themselves, so it's broad.
And not only the objects within the rooms are acquired from around the world, but the materials to construct the rooms.
The architecture was taken primarily from historic structures up and down the East Coast of mm-hmm. the United States. And so we are still trying to work out how all of that happens. There's some of them that we know a lot about. There's others of them that we're still finding out more. And so one of the real joys of working there is that it's a research institution. And so we're constantly learning new things mm-hmm. and sharing them with people.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, Liz, the academic programs connected between Winterthur and the University of Delaware they're internationally renowned programs.
They are. They're very unique, very much ahead of his time. As always, Mr. DuPont started the program in American Material Culture, in which Linda is a professor and leads a lot of that, or most of it. Linda, please chime in on this. That was started in 1952. The other program in conservation was started in 1974. And in fact, Winterthur has graduated hundreds and hundreds of curators.
A lot of the leaders in the decorative arts field in the United States and abroad are Winterthur graduates of the Material Culture Program, and then our conservation program has much more of an international reach, and there are conservators and scientists based in many of the important museums and research institutions around the world who mm-hmm. are graduates of Winterthur.
And I confess, one of my annual indulgences as a former history teacher is to attend your graduate students' presentations, the art conservation presentations, which I have always found fascinating. And I remember saying to, I think it was Joyce Hill Stoner, the first year I went, I said, I had no idea I was going to be attending a day of presentations that were so science-laden. And it was just fascinating to see the combination of the arts and science in the work that these graduate students do
that's what we do is that you need to have both of those, and technical analysis of art objects is something that is a really growing field, and so we're very, very closely involved in that, and that's one of the reasons that we're doing the Treasures on Trial exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at that. It's a nice segue into that. It's an exhibit that's opening on April 1st.
That's right.
And I assume that you have something to do with this exhibition?
Yes, I'm one of the co-curators. Okay. I've been working with my friend and colleague, Colette Lall, who runs a company in D.C. called Art Fraud Insights. And the two of us have put our heads together and have come up with a lot of really great stories about fakes and forgeries. The exhibition title is really what it's about, Treasures on Trial, the Art and Science of Detecting Fakes. And so we really look at it almost as a court trial. And we have an initial section where we talk about the intent to deceive or the motivation and what the issues are with that. We have another section that really is about evidence. We called it evidence. What kind of evidence do you need to prove whether something is either fake or genuine. And then we have a section that talks about the difficulties of proof, because sometimes it's not always easy. And then the final section, which is a lot of fun, is called You Be the Judge. And there are things that the jury is still out on. And so we're going to be asking people to tell us what they think. We're going to be laying out the prosecution and the defense and asking people to vote to see what they think.
Interesting. So there's an interactive component
yes,
to that as
yes,
well.
Yes, there is.
Now, what kind of research was done to find those cases that you're presenting?
Well, what we wanted to do, first of all, was to have an exhibition that was accessible to everybody. So we have a wide range of types of objects. So we have everything from old Dutch master paintings to baseball memorabilia. We've got wine, we've got fashion, we've got Chinese export porcelain, we've got furniture, we've got all sorts of different kinds of things to attract a wide range of people. And then we also wanted to make sure that people understood that this is not an easy thing and it's not a black and white thing. So some of our examples kind of muddy the waters. Sometimes scientific analysis is really clear and you can identify something as a fake, and sometimes that is not going to help you. And so we have a variety of different kinds of things chosen to make those points and to help people understand that whether or not a piece of art is fake is not a black and white kind of issue.
Mm-hmm. Did you, I'm just curious, a thought just occurred to me, did you run across any cases where someone had purchased a piece of art only to find out later that it was not authentic?
Oh, yes. And we have a quote from Henry Francis DuPont himself that says, oh, it's always so much better to find out about the fakes before you purchase them.
That's fascinating. Well, I want to continue in looking at some of your upcoming programming, but first remind our listeners that you're tuned into Delaware State of the Arts here on News Radio 1450 WILM and 1410 WDOV. Our guests in the studio today with us are Liz Farrell, the Manager of Public Relations, and Linda Eaton, the Director of Collections and Senior Curator of Textiles for the Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library. Talking about the Treasures on Trial, the Art and Science of Detecting Fakes, an exhibit opening up on April 1st and running through January of 2018. Time to see that. But one of the things I love about Winterthur, too, is that you can come back so many times throughout the year because with that 60 acres, I mean, the landscape looks different constantly. In fact, we were talking off air beforehand about the early spring that's arriving and what that's doing to some of the vegetation. But that's one of the wonderful things about Winterthur is that because of that landscape in the Enchanted Garden?
Enchanted Woods.
Enchanted Woods. Just so many opportunities to just see beautiful, beautiful landscaping.
Absolutely.
Now, Treasures on Trial, that is opening April 1st, but I understand that there are a couple other exhibits that are reopening with the opening back on March 1st. Embroidery, the language
embroidery
of art.
Embroidery, the language of art. That's one of mine.
I bet you had something to do
yes,
with
I did. I did. It's a really I think it's an interesting exhibition. It really is about the issue of what people call art. Mm-hmm. And what people call art over time. And mm-hmm. so if you look historically, the word art originally meant a skill. Mm-hmm. And so we look at that. But then there have been different periods of time when embroidery has been exhibited publicly and called art with a mm-hmm. capital A. Mm-hmm. And so we go through examples of that. We consider examples of that in America and in London. And so we have an embroidery in there that was donated to us just a year and a half ago that through research on the piece, we've discovered that it was exhibited at the Society of Artists exhibition in 1776 in London. Mm. And that's the kind of thing that people just have completely forgotten about, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so this is a really polemical mm-hmm. exhibition, trying to get people to think differently about some of these things.
Mm-hmm. As a former history teacher who would bring students to Winterthur, could you speak to embroidery just as one example of the decorative arts at Winterthur and how it's not only a demonstration of the arts, but also a demonstration of social commentary and historical documentation?
Yes, because, I mean, especially because so much of it is associated with women, although not all embroiderers were women. There are many professional embroiderers who were male. But very often, it's the survival of those things that are passed off and passed down through families that is one of the only records of a woman's existence. But what it does speak to is women's education, and as scholarship is catching up with these surviving evidence, we're knowing more and more about the level of women's education in the past. They didn't have a certificate or to prove it, but they were very, very well educated women. And then it also speaks to people who might have been forgotten. We have a very, very important embroidered picture done by Rachel Ann Lee, who was a young free black woman in Baltimore. Her mother was a laundress, which was the lowest paying and hardest job that you could have as a woman, and she paid for her daughter to attend a school and do this picture, and she actually paid for it to be framed, and they proudly hung it in her home. So that kind of evidence is something that can easily be overlooked and get lost over time, and so it's very important.
Mm-hmm. And you have another exhibit that's going to be running through early April called Striking Beauties, American Shelf Clocks and Timepieces, which of all the decorative arts, I have always been fascinated by clocks, and I think in part because of their variety of artistic design, but also because they're functional devices, and there's something about them that I've just always found fascinating. A little bit about that exhibit.
Yeah, they're actually scientific instruments, and so mm-hmm. The accurate counting of time is something that people are still working on today, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is a show that's showing a number of our smaller clocks in the collection. And one of the really exciting things about it is that we have a film clip on an iPad where you can watch the works going around and understand what it takes to actually make that, but then what the issues of accurate timekeeping are. So it's a fun and really interesting exhibition.
Mm-hmm. So those are three of the major exhibitions. But Winterthur also has a variety of activities that are going on continually on a regular basis. Many of them oriented to families. Could you speak to some of those kinds of programs?
Absolutely. Well, membership at Winterthur provides all members access to the estate year-round from dawn till dusk, and that includes during the 2 months when Winterthur is closed to the public in January and February. But with our March reopening, a number of new programs are now underway that are really trying to get people outdoors, and we're facilitating wellness with a new wellness program that includes yoga and meditation. We have some new programs for children and family, Storytime and Enchanted Woods, and that's going to be held on the first and the third Thursdays of the month, and Family Nature Walks will be held on Saturdays, select Saturdays from April through June. So we do encourage people to go to our website, winterthur.org, for the latest additions and details on the programs. But certainly in the spring, we were talking a little earlier about all the buds coming up a little bit earlier because of this moderate winter that we've had. And so March 11, the Bank to Bend celebration, which we hold annually. April, we'll celebrate a Daffodil Day. May 13 is Azaleas and Bluebells. And May 21, Peonies and Primroses. Yeah, so April 22, Daffodil Day. And these really include self-guided walks, tours led by our horticultural staff, workshops, lectures, plant sales, activities designed just for children. And really, it's a way, I think we all know that, being outdoors is good for the, it's good for the soul, it's good for the heart, it's good for the mind. And so we really are embracing that and encouraging children, families, anyone who wants to get involved in wellness. We've all been kind of maybe putting off our physical fitness goals. I know certainly I have. So I'm going to be taking advantage of this wellness program and just get out walking, hopefully do some yoga, and we really encourage everyone to come out and enjoy these.
Now, I'm curious, and I'm asking this only because of the what's been in the news a lot lately. What is Winter's source of sources of support? And I ask that only because of, you know, what we're hearing in the news about the National Endowment for the Arts and you know, funding for the arts from, you know, public funding for the arts. How does Winter pay its expenses? What are, I mean, you're part of public relations. Is there a development office? How does that work?
Yes, well, Winter is a 501c3 nonprofit educational institution. We are a foundation overseen by a board of trustees. Mm-hmm. So there certainly, you know, is a part of our overall operations that come from that. Mm-hmm. A large share of what we do is funded through our development office. Mm-hmm. Very fine folks over there. Bob Davis, certainly Dr. Roselle as director of Winter has been just phenomenal at this institution in terms of providing endowments for numerous chairs for the senior positions in curatorial and conservation, and then of course through a membership and general admission,
which is extremely important. And as I mentioned earlier, it really is a beautiful venue to visit, both, you know, the home itself, the exhibitions, the grounds. It's really a magnificent space. Any final words? We've got about 30 seconds left to plug Winter.
Well, I hope you'll come to the Treasures on Trial exhibition because it's going to be a lot of fun and there's going to be a lot of really exciting public programs associated throughout the year.
Yeah, I think that's a great opportunity to see an exhibition where there's that kind of interaction and back and forth, and you know, to you play those guessing games and to weigh the evidence.
We hope it's not all guessing.
No, not all guessing, but really looking at that evidence that you provide.
Amazing.
I think that's really
but evaluating the evidence
and evaluating, which critical thinking is so important.
It's, absolutely,
and it's a great opportunity to employ that in the arts. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Liz Farrell and Linda Eaton from Winter Museum, Garden, and Library. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.